You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the UW-Madison Adapted Fitness Program helps people with a range of disabilities maintain active lifestyles, and the benefits of the classes reach beyond the clients who are enrolled. We'll hear from a student volunteer who works in that program.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. There was a lot of election news this week, with Governor Scott Walker announcing he's running for a third term. There were also elections across the country on Tuesday. It was a successful night for Democrats, which prompted the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to add more districts to their list of battlegrounds for next year's midterms. One of those additions is Wisconsin's 1st District, represented by House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news. Rob, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
Well, all right, Paul Ryan's district, not exactly a nail-biter the last couple of elections, but National Democrats are saying this could be a battleground district. What's behind that?
Sure, well, so this comes out of this big memo that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee released after the elections this week, which were sort of a Democratic sweep in the states that had elections, though Wisconsin was not one of those. It has to be understood as a little bit of chest thumping by Democratic campaign people. That doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't true. They have some polling data on the, quote, huge enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans, and that is something that, I mean, really, it's that is consistent with just our anecdotal experience, right? It's plain to see without the polling data. And there are other data points pointing in this direction. So the upshot is that this could mean that Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, could face a tougher reelection than what he's been used to. Could he actually lose his seat? It's like hard to imagine, but that it is also the sort of thing that is hard to imagine until it becomes a thing that can happen.
And tell us about Paul Ryan's Democratic challengers so far, anyway.
Sure. So this is definitely one factor here is there's a guy named Randy Bryce who has gotten a ton of media attention and raised a ton of money. He is an iron worker and a union member, and he's, you know, sort of able to say things like Paul Ryan ought to try working construction and I'll take his job, which is a popular message for people who don't care for Paul Ryan. He's the other Democratic candidate in the race is the Janesville School Board member Kathy Myers, who is a local elected official. She doesn't have nearly the money or the media profile, and that primary actually isn't until August, if you can believe it.
And then there's new reporting this week on Democratic challenger Randy Bryce from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel regarding child support payments. What's in the news?
Right. This was, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported Bryce had been behind in paying child support for his ex-wife for about 2 years. He finally paid up just after he became a candidate. It really wasn't that much money. He paid off a little over $1,200 this year to get right in the payments. The campaign basically says, you know, he fell behind when money was tight. That's something that a lot of people can relate to, and that he talked to his ex-wife, and they always made sure that their kids' needs were met. But it looks bad, and I think it is something that we will likely hear more about if Bryce does become the candidate.
Then on the Republican side, of course, there's Paul Ryan, and then he had a primary challenger last time around, and some pro-Trump Republicans were making a lot of noise about that challenger because they didn't think Paul Ryan had been sufficiently pro-Donald Trump himself. That ended up being a blowout. That primary wasn't a big road bump for Paul Ryan. Any thought that we could see something like that this year, though?
Right. So he'll have a primary challenge again, and it's very hard to imagine that it wouldn't be a blowout in the Republican primary again. To the extent that the sort of Trumpist base, Breitbart and others had a problem with Paul Ryan, it was during in the period of the Republican primary elections. Since Donald Trump has become president, Paul Ryan has had no significant criticism of him as president or his policies at all. I mean, I think that there's not much space there, and so it's a little hard to see how that that particular, you know, he could sort of lose the Trump base in that way.
And then one huge bombshell this week, and of course I don't want to overlook, Rob, Governor Walker officially announced that he's running for re-election. We weren't ready for this, were we?
Sure.
We didn't know this was coming.
Yeah.
This is out of nowhere.
We had assumed, as we always do, that most politicians just prefer to leave power, and Scott Walker is not someone who has ever shown much ambition. It was quite a surprise all around. But apparently, the political world will have to adjust.
Rob Metzer is with us from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in Wisconsin politics. Staying with elections, Rob, new study from the Center for American Progress shows black voter turnout in Wisconsin dropped about 19% in last year's election compared to the 2012 presidential election. What do you make of that figure?
So that's an enormous number. This is another case where the data comes from an organization that has a partisan motivation. So it's good to take that specific number with a grain of salt. But on the other hand, the data here appears to be pretty solid. For instance, they used voter files, which are publicly available and which show whether a registered voter at a given address showed up or not to vote. And given the unfortunate fact that our neighborhoods are still pretty segregated by race in America, and certainly in Wisconsin, the ability to estimate voter turnout by ethnic group is a reasonable. It becomes fairly reasonable, and I think that the idea of a big drop off is also pretty consistent with what people suspected and had heard. The big question here is, to what extent this is attributable directly to voter ID laws, or to what extent black voters didn't connect with the presidential candidates.
And how do we compare in Wisconsin, again, using this particular method with other states in the country?
Right. That's exactly it. That there's a much larger drop off in African American turnout in Wisconsin, which the key difference is it had a voter ID law in 2016, which it did not in 2012. So there's no demographic reason why African American voters in Michigan would have turned out at such a higher rate or seen such a lower drop-off than Wisconsin, but that appears to be the case.
Finally, I want to move on to an economic story. The Oshkosh Common Council approved a proposal to sell part of a city-owned golf course, and then this has to do with the Oshkosh Corporation getting incentives to build a headquarters there. Can you give us some background on that story?
Right. So Oshkosh Corporation is a massive employer. They make military vehicles. They are a Fortune 500 company with something like 14,000 employees all over the world. And by the name, you might guess, they are located in Oshkosh and have been it's been over 100 years. It's a little bit mysterious, but the word has been that Oshkosh Corporation is looking at the possibility of moving its headquarters. And so city leaders, as you might imagine, have been a little bit freaked out about that and really do not want to see this large employer leave. We don't know. Oshkosh Corporation apparently has not told anyone what other sites it might be considering or what it would take to keep the company in Oshkosh. But in the meantime, and our reporter in Oshkosh, Nate Beck, has been reporting on all of this, the city council has voted to sell a big portion of this public golf course to the company, and then offer about $13 million in tax incentives and infrastructure and aid to the company, in the hopes that when they do decide on this at their board meeting this month, they'll decide to stay.
And this would have a huge impact on Oshkosh, it sounds like, if the company, the Oshkosh Corporation, were to leave.
Right. I mean, this is the headquarters, so there are also some manufacturing jobs. This is the corporate head, but we're looking at 500 jobs and upwards of that would leave. And as well, it's just this it's this identity thing, right? It's a major employer in Oshkosh that there's a lot of pride around that employer too.
And then, of course, we're watching the Foxconn deal here in Wisconsin. The state's Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation approved the $3 billion incentive package. It's on a larger scale, clearly, this incentive than what we're seeing in Oshkosh, but otherwise compare and contrast.
Yeah, it just makes you think. I mean, to some extent, it feels like it's the companies that sort of hold all the power in these cases, and there's no way it's a bit of a race, as it was with Foxconn, when Wisconsin was apparently in competition with Michigan and other states, and so the public officials need to put together these what sound like very large, you know, incentive packages to me, certainly in Foxconn, the largest ever, and it just feels like there's no like, what are you supposed to do if you're the elected official and a company is threatening to leave? It would almost feel like you would have to throw all these resources at it.
Rob, thanks as always, and have a good weekend.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us each week to look at some of the top stories in Wisconsin news.
First, we learned yesterday about programs that are geared specifically towards disabled veterans to help them to engage in healthy, fulfilling, and often therapeutic physical activities.
For a more general population, the UW-Madison Adapted Fitness Program is run through the university's Department of Kinesiology. It helps people with a range of disabilities maintain active lifestyles, and the benefits of the program reach beyond the clients who are enrolled.
Yasmina Ugayor is a student volunteer at the UW-Madison Adapted Fitness Program, and she joins us now to talk about her experiences. Yasmina, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. What is your role at the UW Adapted Fitness Program?
So currently I'm in my senior year as a UW-Madison student in the Rehabilitation Psychology department. I've been volunteering for the past 9 semesters with the program. Students can come in and join the program semester by semester, or you can be like me and just like stay with the program and find a family throughout the program. So I do anything from helping new volunteers learn how to help people with disabilities, or I do projects for Kim Gattenby, the program coordinator. That looks like anything from social media posts to fixing equipment to creating new activities or projects within the program. And whatever they need done in the program, I'm usually happy to assist with anything. And that's the kind of leadership that Tim really looks for in the program. So,
well, and I want to talk about the clients in a moment, but let's stick with the volunteers first. Mm-hmm. Do they come from a range of different majors at the university?
Yeah, so I have friends mostly in the rehab psych program that does this for their practicum, which is an internship you do while you're getting your undergraduate degree. A lot of people are like pre-OT occupational therapists or physical therapist students. We also have like pre-health. Today I just learned there's a business student actually in the program. So you can really come and help out with the program with any major, because you're learning so much about how to connect with people that are experience different life experiences at the time, and everyone can bring a different piece to the table.
And I think I read that there are some engineers who do it as well, because they want to see in real life how the machinery or the equipment gets used and how that equipment can be better. And that really struck me as an unusual opportunity for them.
Yeah, we had actually some engineering students, I think 2 years ago, maybe last summer. They built a bike that could be adapted for children with disabilities, and they often work with Tim Gattenby to find the clients that they could use to test out different equipment. So it's really beneficial that we have this program for people to, you know, take something from the program and make it better such as developing like really awesome adaptive equipment that can be used by our clients, as well as, you know, getting it out there that there's things like this that are being made, and then, you know, kind of marketing it then with that.
And let's talk about those clients. Are they coming from the university community or from the general community?
The clients come from all walks of life. We have patients that, well, we call them clients, but we have people coming from university hospital after a traumatic injury, and, you know, they've gone back home after an injury, and they just want to find their life again, and they want to find activities where they can participate and have fun and connect with people like them and connect with people that aren't like them. So we have people that are young and old. I've been part of the Children's Adaptive Fitness Program. So a lot of students from the Dane County area hear about this through their like physical therapists or occupational therapists at the hospitals. And then they direct them to our program so that they can find new ways to like exercise based off of any condition that they might have. And it doesn't have to be like a physical disability. It can be a cognitive disability, an intellectual disability. It can really be anything.
We're talking with Yasmina Ugayor. She's a student volunteer at the UW-Madison Adapted Fitness Program. And Yasmina, when you get paired up with a client, how do you decide or how do you help them identify what kinds of what their goals are and how to get there?
Mm-hmm. So this step took me a long time, actually. I grew up, my brother has cerebral palsy, so I always wanted to advocate for the clients themselves and ask them what they want out of their workout. So I always had that personal touch, but I never really knew how I was going to ask other people how they wanted to be addressed during their therapy. But this program, Tim is able to break down how you're supposed to talk to clients and how we can get that information from them and then be strategic and be able to create a therapy plan that fits their needs. So that doesn't happen always perfectly. It takes a lot of conversation, and our number one thing is communication with the clients, really getting to know them and know that you're not always going to have the answer, but using your team. The student volunteers all work in teams with the individual clients, so like most groups, they have like 3 or 4 people, and within that group, there's leaders in the group that have been here for multiple semesters, and they're just helping out the program, trying to give back because they've learned so much, and so I kind of start there. It's a conversation. I usually start off saying, I don't ask them what their disability is because I'd rather understand their story because there's more to the person than just their disability. And that's the thing that we learn in our classes, that we need to be able to see them as a human being, and then we can help them find ways to live their life to the best of their abilities that they have left now after maybe a disability, a car accident, a traumatic life event. Mm-hmm. So we're there to support them throughout.
Is there a past client with whom you've worked who was particularly inspiring to you, Yasmina?
Actually, today, during the Adaptive Fitness Program, I was going to share a different story, but today, a client, he has a spinal cord injury, and his parents come with him, and his wife came with him today, and we were like, we want to try this walking light gait machine that we have with him. So he doesn't have any lower limb mobility or anything like that, but he was able to get in a harness today, and this machine is able to pressurize and equalize its pressure so that he's able to stand on his own. And that was such a big step because people with disabilities, they might not have that opportunity. And Tim just got this new treadmill that we can use for clients that might not have good range of motion or blood circulation, so they're able to stand. And today it was just really amazing because we do intervals with him on the treadmill, and we were like, are you sure you want to keep going? And he was like, yes, one more. And then he actually ended up doing 4 2-minute walking intervals, which was really awesome to see. But it's little moments like that where I really consider the privilege that I have being able to like walk and be able to go to a store and not even think about how I'm going to get there. And then you see your client being able to use a harness to be able to take steps. And even though it might not seem like a lot, it was a lot in his life. And he wasn't able to walk for like a year after his injury. Mm. But it was just amazing to see these past few weeks he's been really doing well on the treadmill.
Wow. Is there
it was pretty awesome.
Is there a cost for the clients to participate?
I don't know that specific detail, but I know that they're able to get scholarships if there was a cost. I actually helped fundraise for a scholarship for the children's program. I know there's for sure a cost for that, but I'm not sure if there's a cost for the other students. But a lot of, I think people can get sponsors or they can figure out some financial assistance for the program.
And as we start to wrap up, how do you feel like this class is helping you and other volunteers mm-hmm. with your future career goals? I mean, it sounds like it's very yeah. rewarding personally, but do you see a professional benefit to this?
I definitely do. I just actually applied for graduate school in the occupational therapy program, and I use adaptive fitness as my way of representing what I've learned here in my 4 years. I've grown a lot as a person, and I learned that at the end of the day, it's how you are going to connect with an individual wherever they are in life. And I really have made connections that I know will last for a long time. A lot of the clients, we meet outside and go to the terrace, or we go for lunch and coffee. But I really get the chance to get to know them outside and learn their entire environment, not just their experience at Adaptive Fitness.
And thanks so much, Yasmina. We'll have to leave it there. Yasmina Ugayor is a student volunteer at the UW-Madison Adaptive Fitness Program.
Now, comedian Louis C.K. acknowledged today that the sexual misconduct allegations against him are true. This next segment will have some sensitive content. We advise listener discretion.
The comedian is known for cracking jokes about masturbation in his acts. Here's a clip.
That's not usually my problem. These days, my problem is very simple. It's trying to find a place in my house where I can masturbate without somebody bothering me. And that's really difficult.
Yesterday, the New York Times reported that 5 women said those jokes are connected to his real-life behavior. CK had either masturbated in front of them, asked to do so, or did it when they spoke on the phone.
CK is one of the most popular comedians today. He's sold out Madison Square Garden 8 times, and he's one of several high-profile men in Hollywood, the media, and in politics to be the subject of sexual misconduct, harassment, or assault accusations.
As more reports come forward, it has some hoping that a cultural shift is taking place, changing the way we think about perpetrators and victims.
Jennifer Droback is a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, so many accusations going on here and stories and reports. Are we at a turning point now where we're going to change the way we think about the victims and their perpetrators?
Yes, I think we already have changed the way we view victims, number one. I think rather than viewing these women and sometimes men as complainers or as troublemakers or as sometimes just flat-out liars, we are now recognizing that these are human beings deserving of compassion and vindication. As for the perpetrators, I think we now understand that there are really 3 types. There are what I call the clueless, what I call the careless, and really corrupt predators. I think we do understand better now.
It seems like a lot of the stories we're hearing fit into that last category, in some ways corrupt predators, because again and again, it's not something that someone blundered into once, whether we're looking at reports from the sports world or academia or the media. It's people who did roughly the same thing again and again with the plan, knowing that they were going to get away with it.
Right. These people know what they're doing is wrong. They don't care. And they derive a sense of empowerment and a feel for their own power when they do this to other people.
And a word we've used a lot talking about these cases is high profile. These are ones that we're going to hear reported on in the media when they come out. It makes me wonder what's on the rest of the iceberg, the people who work at restaurants or other low-income jobs who rely on maybe that paycheck to buy food or pay the rent next week and can't risk losing that job.
Right. And I worked prosecuting civilly these cases for about 10 years, and I've seen a lot of different kinds of behavior. It runs the gamut, and we all need to understand that there are different gradations of sexual harassment, everything from the gross elevator eyes to the inappropriate comments of the coffee maker to the very egregious violent behavior, rape, even just outright violence against women that may not take a sexual form but is sex-based, or that's engaged in because these men are now having lesbians in the workplace. So you see the whole range, and it's important for people to understand that just because a behavior isn't severe doesn't mean it's not harassment. It may not be actionable, but still may constitute sexual harassment. And in order for it to be actionable, it has to be severe or pervasive. And frequency is going to be inversely related to severity. So if it's a really serious incident, such as one of the types that we've heard about in the media recently, there only has to be one incident of that for there to be potentially a termination and for it to constitute actionable harassment.
What can people at the top in a business or other organization do to, A, prevent this, and B, create a culture where the victims feel comfortable as possible coming forward to talk about it?
They have to do more than simply say, we take sexual harassment very seriously. That's not enough. So what they need to do is take action. They need to investigate, and thoroughly. They need to make sure that the environment is one in which any trainings that occur with all of the employees, including the top executives. We've heard reports recently that trainings may not be successful. And in my experience, when someone who's clueless is educated, he's typically remorseful and wants to make amends. But when key executives take the attitude that this is a waste of time or that they don't need to have this, you can imagine the eye rolling that would go on. That's when the message doesn't get out, and it actually sends the opposite message, that this type of behavior will be condoned. And so it makes the workplace less respectful and decreases equal opportunity. And that's really problematic for the employers themselves and everyone, because if you don't have a safe and respectful work environment, you're not going to be highly productive. And so we need to see cultural change, and we need these executives to take this seriously. I'm thinking also of the lawmakers that we have in state houses and in Congress. The secrecy and the good old boy mentality, which continues to exist, needs to change.
We're talking to Jennifer Drobak from Indiana University, looking at sexual harassment, sexual assaults in workplaces in just about every walk of life, reports coming out these days. Jennifer, it seems like a lot of these stories people have known. There's a culture of secrecy around this, and there's the idea that this person is one of our most productive engineers, best salespeople, the producer with a golden touch, the candidate we need to win to get the majority. There's a disincentive to take on that person. How do you make the case to an organization that they need to do that?
Well, it's a hard sell if there are no consequences. So if executives and lawmakers and rainmakers can continue to operate without consequences, then they will. So it's incumbent on all of us to do what we can to bring sunlight to this behavior. And so hats off to those women who have finally been able to come forward and say the emperor has no clothes, literally, or to call out this illegal and perhaps criminal behavior. But I think we need to take a closer look at some of the particulars which enable these men to engage the way they have, And that goes to confidentiality provisions in settlement agreements, gag orders. It also goes to protocols that require that a complainant never discuss the incidents again, that they do not disparage the company in any way. And this allows predators to camouflage their behavior, and it allows companies to keep on a rainmaker or someone who's profitable to the company. And I think we need to call that out for what it is. It's pandering. It's basically sacrificing women for the profits of the company. They're retaining a valuable employee, whether he be someone who's a high-profile media executive or a filmmaker or a politician, but you name it. And these people are kept on. They're given renewed contracts, and it's the women around them who are suffering. And in other contexts, we'd call this pandering, and I think we should do it at the polite society level where it's occurring now.
A response we've seen in the past, we're seeing now, often from men, is, well, this couldn't be that big a deal. Why did it take the alleged victim in this case so long to come forward with this? Can you talk, Jennifer, about some of the obstacles that would prevent someone from reporting harassment or even sexual assault?
That's a great question. Some of the problems are best exemplified by recent events involving the President of the United States. This is a man who identified himself in a recorded interview as a grabber, someone who engages in illegal and possibly criminal conduct, and yet we voted him into office. Then the women came forward and said, yes, he did this to me. And what did he do? He called them all liars, which only confirms the fear by many women that they won't be believed. In essence, these women were not believed. And then what did he do? He threatened to sue them all. In other circles, that would be called retaliatory behavior. And that conduct confirms a second fear that women have, is that they will suffer negative consequences if they do come forward. Now, when the most powerful man in the world is able to do that and still operate as the President of the United States, then I think we have to stop wondering why women may not come forward. It's very difficult. I've heard men, even at a conference I was at this week, talk about how, well, there are all these false complaints, and I'm looking at this. Are there false complaints? Yes, they do occur. However, it is so difficult for a woman to come forward and publicly discuss the intimate abuse of her person and her space that there are very few false complaints compared to the number of true complaints that there are. And so I think that we need to vindicate these women. And I think that Louis C.K. did the right thing in doing exactly that. He said it was true. That's part of what needs to happen. Obviously, much more needs to happen. But the coming forward and the recognizing that this isn't just something that is done easily, that this involves shame. Now, that could lead us to an entirely different conversation about the way we deal with sexuality in our culture. If we could talk about it more honestly as a natural part of human functioning and human nature, then there might not be the shame about it. But this is, because we have this shame, these men are able to abuse sexuality in order to empower themselves.
Jennifer Drobeck is with us. She's a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. We're looking at the latest string of revelations about sexual harassment, misconduct, and more by a number of high-profile men.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you believe people are starting to take sexual harassment, assault, and misconduct allegations more seriously? Do you think we're at a turning point? And where do you think we should go from here? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with Jennifer Droback. She's a professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment. We're looking at the latest high-profile sexual assault, harassment, and misconduct allegations and whether we're at a turning point.
You can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the allegations against people in Hollywood, the media, and in politics? Do you think that there's a shift in how the public is viewing victims and perpetrators? And what changes would you like to see in workplace policy or in the law? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org.
And Jennifer, we're seeing more and more women come forward. And there was this Me Too hashtag on social media inviting women to come out and share their stories. Is that something that you think makes a difference?
Yes, it does. Specifically, I actually think it created part of the environment that has prompted this turning point, as you've called it. When you have the high-profile cases of Roger Ailes, Bill Cosby, our own president, and then you get the hashtag MeToo campaign, that really established for many people just how pervasive this is. And this is not something that happens only with high-profile people, or this happens all over, not just in Silicon Valley and Hollywood and Washington, D.C., but in our own state houses everywhere, in our corporations, in our schools. And so when people realize that it's this pervasive, then they really begin to develop an understanding and a compassion, and it allows more women to discuss more freely what's happened to them. I just hope it leads to some changes in the law and some changes in workplace policies.
I want to bring in our callers now. Alex is on the line in Delavan. Alex, hi.
Hi. Your guest was previously speaking about President Trump and how he has been known as a grabber, and I unfortunately have been grabbed 4 times. After those comments came out, I started thinking about it, and you know, I realized that it's been that many. Fortunately, that was a long time ago when I was quite young in my teens, and I just wondered how we can initiate the conversation for young girls and women. I think it's even more difficult for younger people to come forward because the fear of persecution from peers in school is so great. As adults in the workplace, we might be a little bit more comfortable, a little bit more confident coming forward, but young girls, definitely not so much.
Alex, thanks for that call. I'm sorry that happened to you. Jennifer, opening the conversation with girls and young women, and then how about boys and young men, too?
Right. Well, I will actually say that I've written an entire book on the topic of the sexual harassment of teenagers, and it's called Sexual Exploitation of Teenagers. And I talk about not only how teenagers can be abused by adults in positions of authority, but I also talk about how the law should change to empower teens to come forward. So whether it be talking to a school counselor, to a parent, to another adult authority who has a sympathetic ear, I think teens need to understand that there is someone out there to whom they can complain, and they need to. There's help for them out there, and it's incumbent upon those of us who are adults in teens' lives to let them know that we're available for them and that we're available to talk if they ever need help. And obviously, this is not just for girls. Boys can be sexually harassed also, and it's much more common for males to be sexually harassed in school than in the workplace. And so I also talk about that in the book because men and boys faced different kinds of social stereotyping and stigma about coming forward, and sometimes it's difficult for them too. So we need to broaden the conversation and make sure that all of our children feel empowered, respected, and supported.
Alex, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Helen in Rochester, Minnesota. Helen, hi.
Hi. My concern or my thought is that so much of the advertising, especially on sports events and so on, directed towards young men in their 20s and 30s or even their late teens, and we see this is kind of the thing that you're supposed to do. You know, you leer at young women, you are just the general attitude of our advertising. Is this not contributing to the whole culture that our kids, and again, it's on the sports events, they're watching these ads and it's cute and funny, and yet it's really not at all acceptable.
Helen, I want to jump in because we're getting short on time, but Helen, bringing up ads and a lot of other pop culture too, Jennifer.
Right. Helen's absolutely right. And we've seen this for a long time. In my book, I talk about the Abercrombie ads that were there supposedly selling clothing to the teens that came into their stores, but these big portrayals of mostly naked teenagers were really objectifications of children and teens. And what I will point out on that is that parents complained. The adults who were walking the shopping malls complained. And when our culture sends a message to advertising agencies and to corporate America that the messaging is no longer appropriate and will not be tolerated, then companies will change their messaging. And so we all have a role to play here. It, even if it's a small one and it constitutes a call to a business or to a legislator, et cetera. We can all do something about this problem. And I applaud this radio station for doing its part and advancing the conversation with this show.
And briefly, Jennifer, as we wrap up, your message to maybe people in power to try to do something about this.
Right. They have to take it seriously in the sense that they do something about it. We need to change the laws in that we need to end this habit of, or the practice of, insisting on confidentiality provisions. If you want to insist on keeping the amount of a settlement confidential, fine, but the underlying facts should not be confidential. We also need to protect people who fall through the cracks of historic anti-discrimination laws, people who are not, for example, workers of the Weinstein Corporation, but who are independent consultants and contractors.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Jennifer Drobak, professor of law at Indiana University and an expert on sexual harassment.